Money FM 89.3, the best of Saturday mornings. International News Review.
All right, Steve Okun joining us on live here in the studio, as he always is. Good morning, Steve. How are you doing today?
Good. Just trying to stay on top of all the news that's happening beyond Taylor Swift.
Well, no false modesty, but indirectly, does this news involve you? Because you're very close. No, what I mean is, we'll get to it, but you're very close ties to the American embassy, the diplomatic community. Does it affect you indirectly or directly in any way?
Pause for that. What's happening, for those of you that don't know, is that President Joe Biden's ambassador to Singapore, Jonathan Kaplan, allegedly threatened staff, wasted money, and poorly promoted U.S. interests. This is according to an internal watchdog report that was released on Friday. The U.S. State Department's inspector general said that the embassy employees interviewed as part of a regular review process described fear and even direct threats of reprisal from the ambassador, who is diplomatic. Campaign donor who was confirmed as the ambassador to Singapore in late 2021, also developed supposedly poor relationships with some Singaporean ministers, etc. So this is a huge, very important report coming out from the Inspector General's office in the U.S. And Steve, these Inspector General reports do come out regularly. They do look at the embassies around the world on a regular basis. But to have findings like this is extremely unusual, especially for Singapore.
When an Inspector General comes out, and these are not alleged, these are proven and admitted, because the ambassador, I think in a statement, has said he admits to what has happened in this report, that you find that there are activities where the U.S. interest is not put first, but that the ambassador's interest put first, that this has hurt, according to the report, progress on the integrated country strategy, the goals and objectives the United States has. So this does have an impact on U.S.-Singapore relations, which, of course, remain strong and remain critical and remain good at a, of course, country-to-country level and business-to-business level. But clearly, this report shows that this ambassador has not advanced U.S. interest. And you want to applaud the system of the United States government, which shows oversight, which shows transparency, and which shows accountability, and that we will show publicly our warts when it comes to what we do, and that we need to take corrective action.
The allegations, well, they're not allegations, they're proven now, extraordinary, Steve. Just to recap, the report issued that the U.S. Department of State Inspector General found the U.S. Ambassador to Singapore, Jonathan Kaplan's, many projects frequently were unattainable, number one, diverted the embassy's limited resources, number two, and detracted from the staff's ability to perform core duties. Okay, does the report contain any examples of this?
Well, here's a perfect example, which is in the report. In 2022, the ambassador tasked the public diplomacy section of the embassy to have a Super Bowl party that would be free and outdoors in Singapore. Now, the staff would come back and say, one, there's COVID restrictions. Two, Singaporeans don't care about American football. You know, don't waste our time in trying to make this happen. The staff told the inspector general that these obstacles notwithstanding, the ambassador insisted they keep trying to organize a Super Bowl event. Of course it didn't happen. And then the ambassador blames the staff when the event could not be arranged. So you're wasting time, you're wasting money in terms of the resources of the embassy. You're killing staff morale. And so that is an illustration in this report of what happens when you don't listen to your staff, when you don't understand the country, and you don't understand the priorities of the United States.
There are a lot of things that the embassy does. So for those that may not understand or know the structure, there are career diplomats, part of the State Department, that come in that do most of the embassy functions. They rotate every 3 years or so. There are local staff that are hired, Singaporeans and others, and Americans as well, that are hired to fill in other positions around the embassy. And then the ambassador is, generally speaking, a political appointee in many of the embassies around the world.
No, that's the debate, Glenn.
What do you mean?
The embassies are staffed by career diplomats, could be foreign service officers. Yeah. If it's a State Department, foreign commercial service, if it is, you know, the Commerce Department, there's, let's say there's 200 embassies. It's a give or take with about 200 ambassadors. There's about 30. Or now it's like 30% at most that are political. So the political ambassadors are much more rare than a career ambassador. And this is a tension in the State Department, because here you have people who work for decades, who rise to the who are extraordinarily well trained, extraordinarily well versed in diplomacy, in trade, and economics, and now all of a sudden you put on top of them and take these jobs away from them in ambassadorial posts. So there's some tension between political and career when it comes to who should be ambassadors. And then when you get a political ambassador who doesn't listen to his staff, who affirmatively ignores his staff, that gets to be a issue that requires the findings of a report like this.
Yeah. Let's bring it back to Singapore. As you mentioned, he is representing the American government. There was talk in the report of him not being dressed appropriately in Singapore for meetings with the Singapore Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, and even the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, when he met him on the tarmac when he came to Singapore. What was he wearing? Why does this matter?
Well, again, why it matters is because when you have, you know, when you're in any social situation, let alone when you're representing the United States of America, there are dress codes. And the dress codes, you could have smart casual events, you could have, you know, you could have business events, you could have formal events, and you are supposed to follow that. That is what you are supposed to do, especially when you're representing your country. And he ignored what was the required dress code. Almost, I got to imagine it's 95% of the time from seeing the photos on his Instagram account, which we could talk about later too. And so that just sends a message. Are you representing yourself or are you representing the country? And if you are going to meet with the Prime Minister of Singapore or the Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore and you're calling on them and you are not appropriately dressed, that is going to send a signal. Now, if you're great in every other way, except you're going to decide to wear jeans and a t-shirt, you know, and maybe a jacket everywhere you go, maybe that can, maybe you could say, okay, that's a quirk. But when you put it on to everything else that has been done, that's what gets to the issues that the Inspector General talks about. And for example, in the report, the staff told the Inspector General the ambassador appeared indifferent to the embassy's social media priorities and focused instead on the number of followers on his official Instagram account. So again, it's who are you representing and what are you here for? And that's a lot of the thematic that runs through this report.
It is a damning report for sure. And one, I have never seen this level of displeasure with an ambassador from the staff in 20 years of being here myself. And by and large, the staff do amazing work.
Particularly in Singapore.
In Singapore. It is one of the busiest embassies, typically, with all kinds of congressional people coming through and diplomats and everybody else. It is very important. I did reach out to the embassy this morning early when the story broke to get a response. And here is the response that is attributed to Ambassador Jonathan Kaplan saying, I stand by the work of the State Department Office of Inspector General. Their routine embassy inspections are congressionally mandated and are critically important to ensure all of our State Department operations and overseas missions are operating both effectively and efficiently. My team and I take full responsibility for quickly addressing the concerns and recommendations found in the report. It's an honor to work alongside my career Foreign Service peers as I learn from their wisdom and guidance every day. And let me just add one other thing that came in, some additional info that came from a State Department spokesperson, saying the department takes the results of the Office of Inspector General's reports and recommendations very seriously. We're committed to effective oversight. As the report notes, the Bureau of East Asian Affairs and Pacific Affairs in the U.S. Embassy concurred with the Office of Inspector General's recommendations to review the issues cited in the report, and the embassy has already instituted significant organizational and procedural changes to address them.
So that's not a denial. I mean, that reads as an admission of guilt.
And like we witnessed it publicly, certainly at the very first event he did here with the U.S. business community with AmCham, when the ambassador said he came to Singapore and he said And my staff, my team has given me a 100-day plan to follow, and I'm not going to follow it. And this is what he said in front of all of us. And so this is also reported in the IG report. The IG report says he doesn't read the briefing papers that are prepared for him. And so I hope that that response Glenn just read is that he will rely on the incredible staff that he has at this embassy. This embassy always gets top-notch people. And look, when it comes to things like the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is the Biden administration's top economic priority for the United States in the region, you know, we, the business community, or at least I'll just speak for myself, you know, I worked very closely and continue to work closely with the team at the embassy. But I never saw the ambassador engage on IPEF. Yeah. And to me, that is a missed opportunity, because you go back, you know, to Ambassador Lavin when the U.S.-Singapore FTA was going on. I mean, Frank was in this thing, you know, totally in hoping to get that U.S.-Singapore FTA done. You look at what, you know, David Adelman and Kirk Wagger did during the TPP era. They were very involved when it came to that. And yet he is not, but the staff is. And so we continue to work with the staff. Of course we do. And of course, you know, they are great at it, but you miss something when you don't have ambassadorial
Just
engagement.
Briefly, for the benefit of our listeners, this would have been a Joe Biden appointee, right? So what are the ramifications now for him in his post?
Well, when you serve in this position, you serve at the pleasure of the president. So the ambassador requires nomination by the president, confirmation from the Senate. So obviously, Ambassador Kaplan nominated by President Biden, confirmed by the Senate by a voice vote. And so the question then becomes, it's up to, you know, Ambassador Kaplan if he wants to leave. It's up to President Biden if he wants to say, I want you to leave. And until that happens, Ambassador Kaplan is going to be Ambassador Kaplan.
And you don't expect any changes with the upcoming presidential elections, of course.
You would certainly, typical posting for a foreign service posting is 3 years. And so I think the coincidentally here, the end of the 3 year period here would be the end of this year, I think, give or take, which would be the end of the first term if Biden were to get a second term. So you would, as a rule, you would expect to see somebody new come along, because that is par for the course. It is extraordinarily rare for somebody to stay beyond 3 years as a political ambassador. But some do leave earlier to do other things, but that's totally, again, up to that ambassador and up to the president.
It is certainly a distraction that is, I'm sure, the Biden administration is not looking forward to at this particular moment, albeit Singapore is a long way away from the U.S., physical U.S. right now. Okay, let's move on. Mitch McConnell, the leading Senate Republican and been in Congress for a gazillion years, has announced he is stepping down. This follows the Michigan primaries this past week, in which Trump and Biden, not surprisingly, came out ahead. What do all of these sort of inside politics happenings this week mean as we go forward in this political year, Steve?
As somebody who's a, you know, me personally, an institutionalist who likes to see the Senate operate as it's operated more or less, this is a terrible sign, because look, and as Mitch McConnell put it, as he was getting ready to step down, he said, Democrats hate me because of the court and Republicans hate me because of Trump. He ended up in this no person's land. Mitch McConnell used to be beloved by Republicans because he could get legislation through the Senate, because he was a master of that. He had that caucus of all of the Republicans behind him because he was so good at it. And again, from a Democratic perspective, he would use the rules of the Senate to his advantage, I thought unfairly, in making sure the Supreme Court would end up having only nominations from Republicans in recent times. And now what has happened is that, as you know, he's been there for decades. Now the younger senators come in, they don't think of him like, they don't think of it as an institution that they have to respect anymore. They are Trumpers. And the younger ones, like a J.D. Vance or a Hawley, have no respect for Mitch McConnell. Their respect is to President Trump. And so what we are starting to see happen is that the Senate, which has been a bulwark against Trump and for what Republicans used to stand for, strong defense, you know, pro-trade, tax cuts, conservative social issues. That's not the case anymore. So it's a terrible sign. And Joe Biden, when he found out, and remember, Biden and McConnell worked for years together in the Senate. And President Biden said, I'm sorry to hear McConnell step down. I've trusted him and we have a great relationship. We fight like heck. He didn't use the word heck. We fight like heck, but he has never, never, never misrepresented anything. And that's going to change now.
It's not been a great week for Joe Biden, has it? Because Mitch McConnell, whatever you may think about him, has lost that bit of buffering in the Senate. Meanwhile, he's lost a number of votes this week, Joe Biden, protest votes over his stance in the Israel-Hamas war, with more Americans calling for a ceasefire. Not a good week for Joe Biden.
No, it's not been a good week for Joe Biden. It's not over by any stretch of the imagination. But we had a primary in Michigan, and both Joe Biden and Donald Trump got some bad news out of that primary, even though they both won huge, right? Mm. So I think we have to keep that first in mind. Joe Biden and Donald Trump won landslide victories in their respective primaries in Michigan. But again, Donald Trump did very poorly with, you know, independents, with women, with college educated voters, and that is going to hurt him in the general election. Likewise, Joe Biden has come up with a significant number, like in the low teens, of people who voted uncommitted because they are explicitly not happy, and maybe I could even go, maybe they're angry with what Israel is doing in Gaza and that they don't believe Joe Biden is doing enough to stop that from happening. And so they voted uncommitted. So Joe Biden certainly has to be concerned with, can he keep those votes, especially from the Arab American community, from the Muslim community, from younger people who aren't happy with what the U.S. is doing in supporting Israel right now.
It's huge. All right. We have to move on to climate reporting. And this week was a big week for Singapore in terms of some mandatory climate reporting issues that have come up. Talk us through that.
Well, I think this is a very a significant issue, even though it only applies to a small number of companies. But the Singapore government has now said that large publicly traded companies are in the next few years going to have to disclose their emissions. So they're going to have to disclose their own emissions. So what they generate, like if they have, if they're at a factory and they have a generator, or if they operate a fleet, the emissions that come out of the tailpipe. So you have your direct emissions, you have your indirect emissions, and so those are the emissions that come from the electricity that you purchase. But then you also have something called your scope 3 emissions or your supply chain emissions. And so the scope 1 and 2 emissions of a big company in Singapore, right, their scope 3 emissions are from smaller companies. And so this is going to impact smaller companies. Because smaller companies are now going to not be able to say, you know what, I don't have to do all of this work on reducing my emissions. I don't have to do all of this reporting because no one is asking me for it. Well, now maybe the government isn't going to ask you directly, but the Singapore government, through the publicly traded companies, is going to be asking you for it. And so this is going to be significant. Now, there's years, a couple years before all of this kicks in, but it is a great sign to see the Singapore government do this. You're seeing the Malaysian government doing this. Hopefully, you're going to see the U.S. government do this. And we're all moving in one direction, which is we have to account for our emissions, direct, indirect, and supply chain. And the Singapore government is on the forefront of this.
It's great news, as you say. Climate emissions must be reported, different scopes, 1, 2, and 3.
Puts a lot of pressure on
a lot
whole
of
system.
Pressure. But my only question would be, how can they be enforced, Steve? Do we know that yet? It's one thing to report your emissions, but are there any ramifications if you exceed a certain amount of emissions?
Well, no, there's no exceeding anything because there's no law that says you can only use so much.
So then you would argue, what's the point?
Well, there's two points. One of it is going to be public pressure, right? The customers are going to say, well, who do I want to be in my supply chain? If I can have a supplier that is going to have lower emissions than one that does not, it becomes a competitive advantage to be reducing your emissions. We're also moving towards where emissions are going to be more expensive. expensive. And so you see Singapore with a carbon tax. You see the European Union that has a carbon border adjustment mechanism. And so you are going to have financial incentives to turn this down. There's not going to be a law that says you can't exceed emissions, but it is going to hit your bottom line either directly or indirectly. And so those companies that are at the forefront are going to have a financial advantage to do so.
Very interesting. Steve, we got to move on to our final story. Good old Mary Poppins back
in
the
news.
Mary Poppins.
My wife's all-time favorite film.
The 1964 classic film is now getting a change in the age rating in the UK due to what they're calling discriminatory language. On Friday, the British Board of Film Classification upped the movie's rating from U, meaning it contained no material likely to offend or harm, to PG for discriminatory language. What the heck is going on?
I understand why they're doing this, but this is why we have a woke-lash, okay? This is why people instantly come back and say, does the government need to be so heavy-handed in what they do? Look, there's no question that the language that was used when this film came out in the 1960s is not language you would want to use today because it is discriminatory in this instance against black people, and I'll let Neil explain that. But when the government comes out and something on its face is like, Mary Poppins isn't good for children anymore, people go, what's wrong with you, government? And it forces the woke lash that we see. And then it forces people to say, ESG is ridiculous and it oversteps its bounds. So I think there's got to be a better way for governments to work on addressing these issues that have existed from 60 years ago and not being so heavy-handed to end up with a headline that says Mary Poppins is no longer good for children anymore.
I agree with the first part, particularly in the UK. The likes of the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, they love these kind of stories because it taps into this right-wing populist obsession with wokeness as it does in the US, and it distracts from more serious pressing issues. That I agree with. But the second point is it such a bad thing? All they're doing is changing the rating so it might generate discussion, so then children learn that the word Hottentots was actually a racially insensitive term used to an indigenous group in South Africa by the imperialist British Empire, and it's used in the film, just to give context, when the kids are in black soot, so it effectively has a blackface element to it. Is it so bad to have that conversation? That's all it will do. Kids will have the conversation.
No, the conversation is good. And my rebuttal back is, can't you find a way to have this conversation without generating the headlines that Mary Poppins is no longer good for children?
They never said that.
What you're saying it's because you're changing the rating, saying it's not appropriate for them anymore. You can have the discussion without the woke lash. And I think that is what should have been tried to accomplish. And this is going to make things worse, in my mind, and instead of getting the conversation, which you should be having.
But how is it different to say Song of the South? You know, Disney's Song of the South was actually banned in many places because it has an outright racist character. Language evolves, characters evolve, societies evolve. And you move with the times.
And you can say there's degrees of difference. Is one reference, or however many times they use the word Hottentot, which I'd never even heard before now in what it meant, versus a character, which is very different, who is central to the story. So I think you can have a different debate on what you should do and not do. And the Mary Poppins one is not healthy for the woke lash, and it's, I think, going to backfire as opposed to do what we all want, what at least you and I and Glenn, of course, and Max, we'll include Max too, and Aloysius, right, want to see happen.
We got to leave it there, and unfortunately we don't have time for Aloysius's rebuttal because we don't know where he stands on that.
I'm sure he agrees.
All right, we got to run. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next week. Have a good time at the concert.
I may not go. I hope I go. If I do, I will take photos.
If you happen to have young children, keep them away from Steve at the National Stadium.
We got to go, folks.
I'm not the one buying them tickets like you're suggesting.
We got to go.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio at the App Store and Google Play.